Welcome back, everybody. We are switching gears in a sense, but not completely. There is in Baltimore and in Maryland a crisis going on, a crisis in HIV exploding with our young people and with people in this community. The question is why. Same thing with heroin addiction and overdoses. And we're going to wrestle with that because I think that sometimes the official notices about this do not get to the heart of the matter of why this is happening and what we have to do to ameliorate it, to end it, and to change the situation and why it is happening in such a massive way. We're joined by Dr. Louise Edwards here in the studio. She's director of community practice and outreach and associate professor in the Department of Behavioral Health Sciences at the Morgan State University School of Community Health and Policy. Good to have you in the studio once again, Dr. Edwards. Great to have you here. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be with you this morning.
And Jacqueline Rabarge is founder and director of Power Inside, a project of Fusion Partnerships. And always great to have Jackie Rabarge in the studio. Thank you for being here, Jackie.
Good morning.
Good morning. And y'all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, but do join in, 410-319-8888. So let me start, if I might, with you, Dr. Louise Edwards. Just, I mean, that when you read the numbers that are happening here, there's this exponential rise as HIV has been really fought back with medications and people being able to live longer lives. But we've seen this explosion among young people becoming infected in our communities.
Absolutely.
What do you think is going on?
Well, there are a couple of things going on, Mark. I've been working in HIV for maybe about 18 years now. And one of the things that I think is a huge problem is that some of our public health campaigns do not show HIV as the chronic disease that it really is. You know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, people were afraid to acquire the infection. But now we see campaigns that, talk about living with HIV, which you can live healthy with HIV for a very long period of time. But I think where we miss the mark is that HIV is still a disease that you do not have to acquire. It is preventative. And I think that we need to focus more on prevention as well as living healthy with HIV. Young people see folks like Magic Johnson that they talk about, and it's like, if you can look good like this, then you don't have – it's not that
what
bad. All I got to do is
right.
take a pill.
Right.
Everything
right.
is take a pill. But the goal is not to acquire HIV from the beginning.
And I actually had, Jackie, a young person say to me recently, we don't have to worry about getting pregnant because I can take the morning after pill. Right? And
right,
I think,
right.
You know what I'm saying? I mean, there's something where in prevention may be the key. And I'm just curious your thoughts on this before I have a very specific question.
But. Well, I mean, I'm thinking about a young woman that I've worked with. She's now in her mid-20s. I've worked with her since she was 17. And there was a lot more passion around her getting substance abuse treatment, about her fleeing her situation, her abusive situation, about her getting housing. And years later, as those things were on, when she contracted HIV, I was devastated. She was like, at least I might get some services. Mm.
And she makes a good point. Mm. Jackie, that's a great point because I have talked to people who have said to me, if I acquire HIV, I'll get housing, I'll get medical care.
Really?
And I will get food.
And it's not meant in a manipulative way. It's that we're not meeting the basic needs that might eventually spur someone to become positive. So substance use left untreated, homelessness, domestic
Huge.
Violence, all these things untreated can lead to becoming HIV positive. So we're not doing the prevention that has to do with the justice issues on the front end.
Pretty much the social determinants of health, like housing is HIV prevention. Absolutely. Because when you're homeless and you have no place to stay, then you use your body for contractual sex to be able to have a house, a roof over your head. So we have to really think about this from a multi-layered perspective.
And why the exponential explosion among the young?
Well,
I've
been working with emerging adults. Let me tell you, I was young too at one point in time, but they do.
Even
some
I
things.
Was young once.
Yeah, So I mean, they have this. This first of all, this millennial generation is very unique because they are part of the digital age. So they have access to social media and all these other things that are going on. But they don't perceive themselves to be at risk for HIV, even though they have, you know, casual sexual relationships, unprotected sex. They just don't see it.
Your experience?
I started in HIV prevention risking arrest doing needle exchange on the street. It wasn't legal, and we felt that strongly about this needs to be done. And that was at a time where prevention and interventions on the front end really, really mattered. And over the years, we've moved all the way to the extreme of a test and treat model where we assume that if someone gets tested, they will inherently want to get help and protect their partners. But we don't know if that's actually true, especially in the face of the prevention models that we know to be effective. And because youth are so relational and they operate in these communities that are very self-reliant and interdependent, if we're not doing behavioral interventions that speak to that those individual communities, they will become positive. Because we can't rely on them getting tested and somehow magically they will now feel cared about and they will protect their health and they will protect the health of their shooting partners or their sexual partners. It doesn't happen that way.
And if I can add, I think that our interventions need to do a couple of things. One, they need to be more aware of the emerging adult learning preferences. And to be able to repurpose learning, meaning to connect it to the real world.
I like that.
In addition, we have to also think about the determinants of hopelessness. And that basically considers that, we need to realize that emerging adults have issues around the neighborhoods they live in, where there's a lot of decay, violence, poverty. When they operate from a hopeless perspective, they may replace the long-term goals that we were aiming for, like graduating from school, graduating from college, getting a great job, moving forward. And they may replace those with short-term gains. And in this environment, the immediate benefits are more of what they're looking for, such as unprotected sex. When that becomes more attractive than trying to reach for something that I don't see where that's a part of my future orientation.
I wonder, maybe this is off the wall, maybe it's not, I don't know. But when I look at where federal money is going, let's say in this particular area, you know, when we talk about, because pregnancy prevention has seemed to have worked in many ways among young people more than it has not. I mean, the rates are going down.
Yeah, they're going down.
They're going down, right? And part of that's because people are getting birth control and whatever else to keep themselves, women, young women, keep themselves being pregnant. However, the sex education in our schools, or education around sexuality in our schools, is almost non-existent.
Absolutely.
And watered down. And the money that was going to that is now come through, as I was reading this morning, is coming through abstinence training, which is where a lot of the money is coming from, as opposed to being realistic about young people and what they may or may not do.
I mean, the Bush era devastated interventions that were proven to be effective. And every federal grant that you did around HIV prevention, you were required as a condition of your funding to lead every presentation with abstinence. And it was not founded in the science on how people change their behavior. And so it feels kind of not a surprise that the HIV is on the rise in certain high-risk communities. We shouldn't be surprised. But there is a lot of science that we can actually just go back to, which is prevention, 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 using culturally competent approaches in communities, by peers. And, you know, an example of what is one of my frustrations. The jurisdictional plan for Baltimore City for HIV prevention, there is it goes through all the different minority populations who need extra care and prevention. Youth, men having sex with men. Transgendered women. And then when it comes to talking about exchanging sex for drugs, which is among primarily females, one way to get drugs or survive or get a place to stay or to avoid arrest. Now, that is
– Or to avoid arrest. We should explore that one.
Right. And so that community was specifically named in our jurisdictional plan as not to be funded for prevention. So it reads, injection drug users who exchange sex for money or drugs may serve as a bridge group for transmission of HIV injectors and non-injectors. We do not plan to spend behavioral intervention prevention funds for evidence-based interventions. So it says, while these clients are living under the grips of their addiction, their receptivity and availability for any sort of behavioral intervention is limited. So it's the only population we specifically target to not fund.
So, and this, we have to take a break here, but yeah, as we go to break, we're going to come back. If there's news break and get back in this conversation, I have you join us at 410-319-8888. This is a city document, a federal document.
It's a city document.
All right, we'll come back and talk about that. Don't go away. Join us here at 410-319-8888 with Jacqueline Rabars and Dr. Louise Edwards. We'll be right back. Thank you so much for being with us here. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for Cool Jazz and More, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that was I Saw Her Again by the Mamas and Papas. Mama Cass of the Mamas and Papas passed away today in 1974. Baltimore woman, went to Forest Park High School, and one of the leading music people of her generation. We went to break, by the way, with Boys to Men because this is the birthday of Wanya Morris, who is part of the Boys to Men. And you can join us here at 410-319-8888 to be part of this conversation. We want you to join in here and bring your thoughts to the airwaves as we talk to Dr. Louise Edwards, who is Director of Community Practice and Outreach and Associate Professor in the Department of Behavioral Health Sciences at Morgan State University School of Community Health and Policy, and Jacqueline Rabars, Founder and Director of Power Inside at Project Diffusion Partnerships, 410-319-8888. Now, we left off talking about this piece that you read, Jackie, from city policy about not intervening when people are addicted, actively addicted, and sex workers. Mm-hmm. Is that what you just
wrote? Yeah.
And you were in the break, you all were having a conversation about addiction in the city and the rates and...
Yeah, so I guess, you know, when one of the things is I think it's awesome that we've got all of this data that we're gathering. This is a data town. It's a very academic place.
Yes.
But when you go out on the street, it's a little more difficult to divide people out by specific populations. And so people are in communities where one person may be trading sex for drugs, another person may be panhandling, and, you know, there's different mutual aid where they're sharing and taking care of one another. So it's not all negative. But at the same time, you can't easily tease out a community or a person based on, like, the population category they fit in. And so sex workers are not, like, a separate group of people off doing this behavior. You know, at any given time, a woman who holds the lowest rung on the drug, you know, in the street economy, she could be trading sex because women are just like our legit economy. Women are holding lower rungs on the pay scale. Sex and panhandling and boosting and street level dealing. Women are very visible and vulnerable to all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to sex, And females, it's a very, very risky business because they are, you know, vulnerable to many, many factors. And so the fact that we kind of parse out this very large set of behaviors of trading sex for drugs and knowing that it has overdose risk, it has risks of violence, it risks HIV.
Absolutely.
And it's a really available survival strategy. If you don't have anything, you've got your body to trade. And so it's an available commodity that, you know, we need to kind of look at and address specifically. We can't keep putting sex exchange under other identity populations because HIV is transmitted largely by behaviors. And, you know, sex exchange is a behavior.
Yes.
And there are ways that we can put people who have traded sex, like we do at Power Inside, out on the street to have conversations with people who are trading sex. And at the same time, that street outreach, which is a known HIV prevention intervention used all around the world, it also has other great benefits, like reducing violence, like observing the police, like providing referrals to community members. And it's a very positive thing. I think people sometimes think that it's this kind of the underworld of outreach. But, you know, when we go out on the street, we've got business merchants saying hi and, you know, people offering us, you know, if you want to use our bathroom. And it's a very positive thing because everybody knows we're there to help.
It's part of the problem. Do you want to say something before I jump in here and ask a question?
Okay, well, I was just going to say sex is a product, so we need to begin to look at that as a product. It's a product. It sells.
But maybe part of the problem is when we talked on the break, I mean, there's a huge heroin addiction problem in our communities in the Baltimore area. Not just Baltimore City, but throughout the entire Baltimore metropolitan area and the state. As you were saying during break, Jackie, 303 people OD'd from a heroin or alcohol overdose in the last year in Baltimore alone. That's almost one a day in the city, or coming close. At least it was one a day before. Now it's that, but that's still a huge number of people who die. And it's part of the problem is that we, is as long as. And let me just say this. I mean, and also there's the National Institute for Drug Abuse has said that only 11% of the addicts in our country, I'm sure the stat's not too different here, who need treatment get it or have really any access to it. And what does that treatment mean?
Those are very good points.
So and it's part of the problem, though, because of the – is that as long as we continue to criminalize the behavior, you're never going to get to the bottom of helping to cure the illness.
Yes. I agree, because substance abuse should be approached from a medical issue. I mean, what's your point on that, Jackie?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm thinking about I met with a woman recently who has a warrant, and she's 5.5 months pregnant.
Mm.
And she is homeless, and she is surviving day to day, and her only goal is, before she turns herself in, is to give birth on the street. But she can't present herself for treatment, for health care. She's trying to muddle through with prenatal care because she really cares about this pregnancy and her health. But, you know, if we're also looking at maternal child health, we have to look at the way the criminal justice system had previously targeted her for low-level survival-related and drug-related crimes that now has kind of ensnared her in an endless series of probation conditions and potential violations, which is what she did. She violated a very low-level misdemeanor, and now she is terrified about giving birth behind bars.
And, you know, you brought up a good point, because when we did the African-American Why Women, Black Women and Girls Matter, there was a panelist who talked about actually giving birth in shackles.
Right, that happened. You know. That's a huge problem in our prison system.
So,
with women.
I mean, the war on drugs and mass incarceration is not at all separate from the health. You know, and if we're talking about public health, because if we are trying to filter all illnesses, mental illness, substance use, poverty, and everything else through the criminal justice system, we're not going to do a very good job, because people are getting hurt and traumatized in arrest. They go in a jail that right now a federal lawsuit was reopened. There are all sorts of health issues in the jail. And when they come out, there's no guarantee that they're going to be able to even access treatment on the way out. And it's very costly to process someone, even for a day or 2 days. The courts and the criminal justice system should not be a solution to substance abuse, even if we're offering people treatment. We should always be offering people treatment, but why is it easier for our clients to get substance abuse treatment or help for a mental health condition if they end up arrested and adjudicated versus us calling on the phone and saying, hey, do you have an opening? which is something I was doing, you know, which we do every day, just making phone calls. Hey, do you have any openings today? We've got someone who needs help.
And, you know, I have that same – sorry. We have that same problem with people in our projects who are – where we are, you know, doing HIV prevention work who have issues with substance abuse. We call to get them in for treatment. It's hard to get them to the point to accept treatment.
Yeah.
And then they say, we can see them in 3 weeks. 3 weeks, I might not know where they are.
And what happened to the – I'm going to go to the phones here. But what happened to the idea that we had treatment on demand?
Yeah, and I was happy to see that in the city's overdose prevention plan, the very, you know, sweeping recommendations they made were really, really wonderful. And the goal should be treatment on demand. But I think, we can have treatment on demand, but then if you looked at the flip side, which is the criminal justice recommendations, it was actually leading with more enforcement on drug corners. And I am not sure why an overdose plan would have a recommendation lead with enforcement.
Because heroin's illegal, and so are every other drug, and we put people in jail for using it, selling it, and being around it. That's why.
And this kind of myth of this drug dealer, some of these folks are drug users, and they're very pretty much small fries.
So, folks, what do you think? We need to get your thoughts and ideas here. It's 410-319-8888. The rise in heroin addiction, overdoses in our community that's seen as a crisis by Governor Hogan, but others, what they recommend, is that the way we need to go? What are our city policies? 410-319-8888. Carmine in Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, actually, my name is Carmen, and I'm glad to be on the
show. Carmen, I'm sorry. Yes.
Not a problem. Hi, Jackie.
Hey, Carmen.
So I'm calling as someone whose first job out of high school was HIV prevention. All my life since I had the capacity to be a sexual person, HIV has existed in my life. So we have to accept that HIV is pervasive in all of our lives at this point.
There's yes.
no corner you can go to, no category of protection. And what's fascinating to me is that I came into HIV testing and counseling prevention work. So testing was even a consideration based on pre-test counseling, helping people understand that their behaviors did put them at risk, that taking a test could change their lives. Even if that test result came back negative, you've done a consciousness-raising effort so that as people move forward in their lives and into their communities, they were able to make new decisions. And seeing now that testing is simply a transaction itself that we expect to see, and in fact we mandate that we see a certain percentage of HIV-positive folks. And those are the only people that we're testing that we're paying attention to, mind you. Those people who are testing negative, it often looks like, great, you're not positive, get off the van. And we'll see you when we see you, come back next year, something like that.
Right.
But folks who are positive, we expect that somehow their lives will become suddenly stable, that the medication regimen, which is a lot simpler than it was in the 90s, yes, but it still requires focus and structure and access and stability in your phone number and your mailing address and a place to keep your meds, in a lifestyle that keeps your stress low. So with all the exciting data that HIV transmission rates are very low in those with undetectable HIV rates, we still are avoiding the reality that most of the folks who are at risk of infection are the people who are most destabilized in our lives. And so we're not helping stabilize the folks who are testing positive. We've taken out a conversation around behavior change and having conversations around sexuality and being responsible for our bodies and how we are in the world. And that really concerns me. And this idea of categories, I can't think of an HIV risk category that doesn't include the possibility of sex. And I can't think of a drug-using category that doesn't include the possibility of multiple drugs of choice. So you have HIV and heroin being linked. But HIV and crack cocaine should also be linked.
Right.
Seeing heroin being the focus of our governor now, he needs to remember that crack cocaine is still viable, even for folks who are in treatment for heroin. So any funding strategy, any public health mandate we have right now should be as intersectional as our public social justice issues that we're working on right now. They're interrelated, and I'm really sad to see in 2015 a single issue focus. And we've got to broaden the conversation. Public health is for all of us.
Carmen, I think I'm really glad you called in. I think the thing you just laid out for us, for our listeners, our panel, is really on target, at least from my perspective. Let's get our panel's thought on this. I mean, I think the intersectionality is key to this. We separate things, and so we see all of a sudden, and I must just say this, I mean, and I hope people don't take umbrage of this, and I hope the governor's office doesn't take umbrage as well, but as soon as we see there are heroin problems in Baltimore County and Howard County and Cecil County, then it becomes a problem. That we have to address. Even though it's always been there, now it's being seen. And law enforcement, seems to me, is not the way out of it. And as we had a show here yesterday about homelessness and people living in encampments and what we can do to do that rather than tearing down their tents until you figure out how people can live a different kind of life, that this all is tied together, from housing to stability in people's lives to even the question of not arresting people for heroin. Maybe heroin, I'll throw out there, should be legal so that people don't go to jail for it while they are fighting to get rid of their addiction. I mean, it seems to be, and I guess I'm saying this after years of working this myself before I got on the radio, and the last 22 years of being on the air, of saying the same things over and over and over again for the last 22 years. This conversation, I don't think, has changed one iota from March of 1993 when I did my first program on the problem of heroin addiction and sexually transmitted diseases in our community.
And we have an equal number of people using crack cocaine, so I'm glad Carmen brought that up. When I read the overdose plan for the city, it mentioned that 50% of the people entering treatment were for heroin. That's significant and important, and we've lost a lot of our clients to overdose. So I don't want to minimize that, but who are the other 50% entering treatment, and what are their lives like?
Right.
And when we talk about crack cocaine, we live in a place where we just recently, our president, equalized the sentencing between powder and crack cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very racialized sentencing policy. And so we need to also consider the fact that race, and I think for all nonprofits, all health organizations, every discipline, every person right now needs to look at things and get on board with this incredible movement. And so we need to look at health policy also through a racial justice lens. And the kind of ignoring the fact that crack cocaine in people's lives is really significant and deserves some specific attention, is it could, if we looked at it, have a racialized impact and also a disproportionality in funding, in intervention, in research. We are leaving people out to die on the street or get locked up.
It's unfortunate. And as our speaker, our caller in said, I mean, all of these issues that we're talking about are overlapping and interrelated. And until we begin to address them from perhaps a socio-ecological model where you have the individual level, the policy level, the community level, we aren't going to get far.
I'm going to get to the phones here, but I do want to explore before we run out of time. Do you think it is possible for – so I have to put in your head before we go to the phone call – possible for our political structure – to actually create a campaign, to actually create a strategy, short-term, long-term, that is intersectional and actually can work? What would it mean for them to do that? I'm going to go to the phones and come back and talk about that. 410-319-8888. Eugene, you're on the air.
Good discussion for sure. I have a wife. My wife works at Union Memorial. She's the ER doctor, and she sees all the time of folks coming in, heroin addicts, various drug seekers, and one of the things that happens with them is, as Mark mentioned earlier, a lot of times, not just taking the morning after pill, they'll just, you know, have abortions as if it's birth control, you know. So I think it's just about being responsible in general, whether it's HIV protection or just pregnancy prevention. It's just folks have to be more responsible, but it's very difficult because, as you already mentioned, it's all interrelated. It comes down to, like, self-awareness, education, pride in what you're doing, and it's hard to just focus on one aspect of a very deep part of the problem. Just focus on the one area, man. It's a lot of stuff that has to be done mentally and emotionally to get people in the frame of mind where they feel their lives really matter enough to be responsible.
Gene, let me ask Dr. Edwards to comment.
He makes a very good point. We have to look at the issues of substance use, HIV, sexual behaviors all together because they have the same risk factors and they are definitely interrelated and they overlap. And until we begin to do that, we're just treating a part of the problem and not the entire problem.
Yeah, and I think we also have to remember that, you know, substance use and people deciding to change or not change is a continuum. It's actually been laid out by as the trans-theoretical model of change. And it says that people go through stages as they think about and take actions toward change to ultimately make and achieve a change. But so when you just kind of blanketly say it's a matter of self-awareness or education, I meet people that are so self-aware. So incredibly self-aware, have considered all the harms through their life and what they have kind of used substances for. And even that self-awareness doesn't get you a treatment slot.
No, it doesn't.
Right.
So at that point that someone, you know, you'd walk people through that step, and then we need to be able to have the resources and sensitive people who haven't given up, you know, several years back when they didn't have that self-awareness.
And you made a good point, resources, and not just resources, access to resources, and then culturally compatible people yeah. who are there to provide services. Because sometimes when people do access services, the employers there, the people that they have to interact with on a daily basis, really begin to make the whole picture turn. And I know people who have had access to services but were treated so bad mm-hmm. and stigmatized that they felt like they didn't want to come because they weren't comfortable meeting with healthcare providers.
Absolutely.
So how do you think, before we have to break to our next subject here, and meet some young people who are spoken word artists in our community and hear from them, so what about the idea that how can government, people who actually make these policies from the upper level, begin to do the things we're talking about? I mean, is it possible to make that kind of intersectionality of that kind of approach happen?
Well, my point, what I would say, Mark, here is that perhaps the people who make these decisions, how knowledgeable are they about the social conditions that we are discussing here? I think sometimes some of our policy people really don't – they aren't on the street in ways that will give them the inside. But can they do it if they want to?
And if they want to, I mean, Jackie, let's say I'm the mayor and I hire the two of you to be my key advisors to make this thing work in our city, and how we begin to do it. How do we do that?
I mean, I think I mean, I don't think Larissa and I could do it on our own.
And I don't think I'm going to become the mayor either.
I'm just saying. I'm going to stay in my lane.
But I would love us to do street outreach together. That would be awesome. But – I mean, I think we need to really kind of return to some of the public health strategies that – I mean, we're talking about Project Safe Streets, which is public health street outreach to reduce violence.
Right.
It's a particular type of outreach that isn't mm-hmm. being lauded right now. Why are we not returning to harm reduction street outreach on a massive scale so that we can really dig into those entrenched communities and really get to know people? We did that. We're such a small program, but we did that on one corner. We got to know we've gotten to know like 60 or 100 women just on one corner on this open-air drug market. All the merchants, all the churches, all the women, how old they were. And we became part of the community and inserted positive strategies into the existing ecosystem. And it works. And it's a very compassionate and culturally competent way to approach things. And so we need a lot of like deeper level community-based public health outreach and work. And the strategies are out there.
This has been a great conversation, and I do appreciate the work that both of you do, incredible work. I want to thank Dr. Louise Edwards, Director of Community Practice and Outreach and Associate Professor in the Department of Behavioral Health Sciences at Morgan State University's School of Community Health and Policy. Great to have you in the studio, Louise, and we look forward to coming back.
Oh, absolutely. This problem continues to go on, Mark, and the only way we're going to address these things is to keep the discourse going.
And we'll do that here. And Jackie Robarge, Founder and Director of Power Inside, a project of Fusion Partnerships. The work you do on the street is amazing, and I'm glad we can do a little bit to let people know what that's about and hear your voice and what you're trying to tell us we need to think about. Good to have you.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. We're going to go to break here with Crash on the Levee by Bob Dylan and the band. On this day in 1966, Bob Dylan got into a motorcycle accident, completely left the public eye for 9 months. In that time, he wrote over 100 songs and recorded them with the band and released an album called The Basement Tapes. Six songs from that album. We'll be right back. Stay with us. We're about to meet some incredible young people. Don't go away.
Put your cup down so I can take your picture.
Please.